Welcome to Computer Game Evolution, a podcast about the evolution of computer games. Episode 3.10. A Leap Forward. Previously, the world discovered climbing and jumping and dropping things on top of enemies to kill them. Now, 1984 has come, and both the video game industry and players are putting Dun into Donkey Kong. Only 3 years prior, Shigeru Miyamoto's accidental debut impressed the crowds with, like, four different new games packed into a single title, and now it's old, and Nintendo has to deal with overstocked displays piling up in a warehouse by inventing dual-screen cabinets. That's not to say that games with simple arenas where you hopped over obstacles on the way to some goal were dead and buried, they were still coming out on microcomputers. But for those juicy arcade profits, still very respectable even after the crash, developers had to try harder. The people's taste in bread and circuses was getting too sophisticated. Speaking of circuses, still enjoying the worldwide popularity of its track and field, in 1984 Konami released another somewhat athletic game full of events good enough for a clown to do at the circus. Circus Charlie. Like Mr. Door from 1982, Charlie was a clown, but unlike Mr. Door, Charlie was not armed. It would have probably looked bad if he had been, seeing as he had to perform in front of a live audience. For his first trick, Charlie rode on the back of a lion, jumping over pots of burning oil and through flaming hoops. The pots were just sitting there on the ground, easy enough, but the hoops were connected to some mechanism and scrolled forward automatically, right in Charlie's face. If the clown survived all this fiery death and got to the end of the stage, he advanced to walking on a tightrope. Except Charlie wasn't the only one on the rope that day. He shared it with a horde of monkeys marching the other way. Brown ones simply walked forward at a steady pace, but purple monkeys ran fast, leapfrogging over slower primates, and were a pain to dodge. If Charlie survived that, he advanced to the trampoline stage, where you bounced along a chain of trampolines to the finish. But on that day, the circus was also booked by a fire breather and a knife thrower, so you had to time your movement to evade their projectiles. Oh, and if you bounced on the same trampoline 4 times in a row, it would launch Charlie into the roof. If Charlie survived this ordeal as well, he could rest easy, knowing he was halfway through the events. Next, Charlie faced big balls. He had to roll on them and hop between them to get to the end. The catch was that you didn't want Charlie's current ball to touch any of the balls rolling on the stage, because they bounced off of one another, leaving the clown in the air for a moment before a nasty fall. Also, Charlie's jump distance was fixed, so jumps from one ball to another took a good aim. After that, Charlie went back to riding on the back of a horse, and unlike the lion, the horse could not be stopped. You could adjust the speed, but there was no stopping that beast ever. Even to finish, you had to jump off the horse precisely onto a stationary platform. Before that, Charlie had to hop over special hurdles that were topped not with bars, but with springboards. Then came the dreaded trapeze stage, where Charlie had to leap from one swinging trapeze to another, not really threatened by anything apart from gravity, and, you know, having the entire height of the circus to fall down from. Although occasionally there were trampolines you could fall down on to bounce back onto the next trapeze for extra points, but good luck timing that. After the trapeze, the game cycled back to the lion run, but those were not all the tricks in its arsenal. After every 10th stage came a special dolphin trampoline challenge, which was almost like the regular trampoline level, except the circus was flooded and Charlie had to dodge dolphins jumping out of the water. So overall, Circus Charlie was like 7 circus circles of clown hell. Charlie's Suffering was profitable for Konami, got a couple of home system ports, but failed to develop into a major franchise, even though the game had plenty of now popular secrets, nonsensical things you could do for extra points or extra lives, things you'd only learn about from a magazine. At the same time, a lot of mechanics of Circus Charlie were old-fashioned, like a recap of the previous episode, automatically scrolling stages, rigid jump arcs, swinging on vines, and there was also collecting bonus items, bags of money. In America, you too could find a game pining for the old days with a dash of something new. At the very end of December 83, a dying Atari released its farewell letter to all the preceding years of vector graphics gaming, Major Havoc, designed by Atari veteran Owen Rubin, with some help from Mark Cerny. The cabinet puts you in the shoes of a clone of a great hero, Major Rex Havoc, who had to pilot his... his Catastrophighter through space and waves of alien ships towards an alien base in a third-person scrolling shooter-like segment, then land on the base in a lander-like segment, and after that, things got really interesting. A side view of the space station's maze-like interior would appear on the screen, and it was a pretty big base, so it scrolled and you got a mini-map, and then you would run and jump to the left and to the right, following the helpful arrows on the walls to reach the station's reactor, to disable it before your oxygen ran out, after which you had to run back to the fighter pursued by the threat of an imminent nuclear explosion. Then the whole game cycle repeated. Later levels deployed new enemy patterns in the space stage and more advanced station maze layouts, where you now had to collect oxygen refill power-ups to last long enough. Rubin had even drafted an epic homeworld stage, where the maze would be 4 times as big and the player had to trigger 4 reactors and escape in one go, but that was never implemented and it would not have fit into the ROM in the first place. Still, the maze levels did change considerably with each cycle, because you would start seeing new threats, arrow gates that only let you pass them one way, deadly floors, things that bumped you onto those floors if you jumped poorly, automatic turrets, disappearing walls, locked doors you had to find keys for, and eventually the aliens would even figure it out to remove the arrows leading you to the reactor so that you had to find it yourself. Oh, and there was a cute robot arm that would disarm the triggered reactor immediately, so Major Havoc had to turn the arm off first by flicking a switch somewhere else in the level. You'd also start seeing teleporter gates that moved you and enemies between different parts of the maze. It may sound a bit familiar to some, and I think it is possible that Owen Rubin had seen or heard about Synapse Software's Fort Apocalypse from 82. The game did get some publicity, and of course, Owen owned an Atari 800. He actually pulled off a whole scheme to get one from Atari for free. Around 1980, Rubin volunteered to make a game for the Micro, the company gave him the computer, then he made a Yahtzee adaptation Atari could never release because it didn't have the license. But Owen got to keep the computer. Going back to Major Havoc, in particular its jumping controls, I need to mention that you move the Major left and right by rolling a trackball, as had become the custom in Atari's vector units. The jump button lets you control the Major's jump height by changing how long you pressed it down. You had pretty good aerial control in station's low-gravity environments, and in some of the later stages, you would even find anti-gravity boots that let you briefly hover or try to boost up. The boots could also come in handy to break your fall, since Major would get stunned for a moment after hitting walls and floors too fast. Rex Havoc had no weapons while on foot, and apart from crafty jumping, the only thing that protected him from attacks was a shield that could be turned on to absorb 1 incoming hit per use, and it didn't come with many uses. If the shield and your skills failed, the Major died, first turning into a skeleton and slowly dissolving. That's another strong point of Major Havoc, by the way. Amazing animation, made even more amazing when you realize that the system didn't have the power to render wireframe 3D graphics in real time, so the developers had to animate most of the pseudo-3D effects by hand. But the result was a seamless transition from space battles to landing to the maze and back to space again. The enemies moved smoothly, their attacks had sparkles around them, everything was full of color, and the game even offered sight unseen, idle animations. You know the ones that play when you leave your character standing in one spot for a while? In this game where you're always on a timer? Rex Havoc would try to do a balancing act when perched on top of walls. Standing near a wall, he would turn to face the player and lean against the wall. And without any walls in sight, the Major would face the screen, fold his arms, and start tapping his foot. And the funniest thing about this is that, as we know, Mark Cerny, who was helping with the later stages of the cabinet's development, ended up at Sega in the late 80s, and even though he says he wasn't directly involved in the creation of Sonic the Hedgehog, Sonic's idle animations included frantically balancing on the edge of a platform and staring at the screen while tapping his foot. The video game industry is full of these mildly suspicious coincidences. Unfortunately for Major Havoc, most players could only get to it in 84, when the American video game industry was in its desolate wasteland mode, vector graphics were being retired, and the system had too many new bits inside, so Atari insisted on selling them as whole cabinets instead of more affordable conversion kits, and that impacted the sales. So this brilliant game never got the follow-ups it deserved. It wasn't entirely forgotten, it had fans, but a Major Havoc 2, blending together even more types of games in cycles of escalating complexity, was not to be. However, Major Havoc did play a major role in Japan. In 84, ASCII Corporation released a very similar microcomputer game called Theseus, made by Major's fans. In Theseus, you played as the Greek hero trying to save his love, or some other lady, in an assortment of mazes. The game clearly imitated vector graphics with sprites, it used Major Havoc's floaty controllable jump physics, there were switches opening doors, lava pools you had to leap over, and enemies to avoid. To save the damsel in distress, you had to reach her while holding a key and a ring, and sometimes the girl would be right there at the start of the level, but the two items were stashed away beyond hallways of traps and monsters. Another change from Major Havoc was that touching threats no longer killed you instantly. Theseus started with 600 hit points that would start ticking down rapidly on contact with baddies, but lightly brushing against them was no big deal since you'd get 100 points back for beating a level. Not only was it less punishing than arcade games, but it also made taking damage to save some time, there was a timer too, a viable strategy. Since we've moved on to Japan, let's check up on another company we already know. What's Universal up to in 84? The company that has given us Space Panic is doing a bit of reorganizing. It had a division called Universal Playland, which had been around for a few years, bringing over late 70s American cabinets into Japan. It looks like in the early 80s, Universal Playland began producing original games, and to keep this label distinct from Universal, the division was renamed to UPL Company. In 83, it released Mauser, a game where you controlled a cat trying to chase away all the mice in a multi-story house, climbing ladders, jumping over projectiles, and collecting tasty fishies for points. Yum. But a bit stale. In 84, however, UPL developers got inspired, and in the autumn, the company released Ninja-kun Majo no Boken, Ninja Kid, Magic Castle Adventure or Demon Castle Adventure. Ninja-kun himself was a ninja of childlike proportions, wearing a red hooded robe and a white mask. He was armed with shurikens, and his mission was to kill all evildoers standing between him and an ominous castle, and then deal with the evil in the castle itself. The game had only three stages it cycled between: the bottom of a mountain, the middle of the mountain, and the castle at the top. But the stages were tall, so tall they needed vertical scrolling. Jumping between the rock ledges and the roofs along with Ninja-kun would be the enemies you had to take out to beat the level, 8 of them in each. That doesn't sound like much, but like in Mario Brothers, with every stage and then cycle, you'd see different enemy types in various combinations, and those could get very tricky. One level you'd be fighting simple ninjas like yourself, some other you were dealing with dragons spreading long-lasting flames all over. Unlike Mario Brothers, Ninja-kun still used old-style fixed arc jumps, so bad positioning could trap you. However, the game also did something I always appreciate, especially this early on: enemies did not hurt Ninja-kun on contact. Well, apart from the ball of fire that appeared if you stayed on the same ledge for too long, but that was kind of the point. Other enemies, however, hurt you only with their weapon attacks. If you bumped into their bodies, you both bounced back a bit, no harm done. If you landed on top of an enemy, you knocked them out for a moment, and if they landed on top of you, they knocked you out. So while jumping was rigid, you were rarely in a situation when an enemy touched a pixel of your boot and you died. Ninja-kun had a light element of gambling in it too, which is a bit funny if you remember that 82-83 had been the period of police crackdowns on illegal video gambling in Japan. Each defeated enemy dropped a scroll you could pick up for extra points at the end of the stage. One of the 8 scrolls would show a princess, which doubled however many scrolls you had at that point. But one other scroll would have a monk that reset your collected scroll count to 0. And you didn't know what you'd be getting since it was random, and you had only a couple of seconds to decide whether to push your luck before a dropped scroll vanished. The game had more regular bonus items too, orbs which fell from the sky once per level, and if you collected a set of three, you'd go to a bonus stage. Published by Taito, Ninja Kun must have done well in arcades, but likely lacked the international appeal since the cabinet never made it outside of Japan. In 85 it got a Famicom port, and an MSX port that even escaped to Europe. Later the same year, the company that did the Famicom port, Jaleco, released its own console spin-off Ninja Kun, which developed into a series. In 1987, the original Ninja Kun sequel was released in the arcades, both in Japan and the United States, localized under the name Rad Action, and this was immediately followed by many more home system ports. But we'll put that aside, as we've got another sort of new company to introduce. The company is Teikan Electronics. There are two things that need to be said about Teikan to start with. The first one is that today, even in this period of its existence, the company is sometimes referred to by its more famous name, Tecmo. However, in the early 80s, there was no Tecmo. There were two companies with Teikan in their name. In 86, one of them changed its name to Tecmo and announced a new focus on console titles. Then in 87, Tecmo and the remaining Teikan Electronics merged for stock market reasons. The second thing I'll point out about Teikan is that in the early 80s it was getting a large portion of its developers from Universal. It got kinda silly with nearly half of them being ex-Universal people. There was even a saying in the Teikan offices that unless you'd come from Universal, you could not get a promotion. By the way, one of the guys who'd migrated over was Kazutoshi Ueda, the planner of Space Panic. Naturally, back at Universal, the management was not too happy with this Atari-Activision dynamic. And whenever a developer was leaving, they'd get the talk. Okay, we understand you maybe got a better offer, want to try yourself at a new place, and we're fine with that. But if you go to Teikan, you're dead to us. And then the developer walked out the door and headed for Teikan, where all their buddies were working. I could have introduced Teikan back in the scrolling episode, because in 82 it released a cabinet called Swimmer, about controlling a dude swimming up a vertically scrolling river and dodging vicious crabs, turtles, and logs. And it's a game with an absolutely glorious Japanese promotional flyer, while its Western flyers look like crap. But I think today's game will make a far better introduction, since it's Bomb Jack from the spring of 84. Bomb Jack was yet another post-Mario Brothers game of going through single-screen stages filled with enemies, but it offered its own twists to the formula. Unlike murderous Mario Brothers and Ninja Kun, to superhero Jack, enemies were merely obstacles trying to stop him from reaching his main objective. Remember how in the 70s international terrorism became a big topic? Well, it's a joke now. Some villains had planted big red bombs with fuses all over the world, and Jack had to collect those bombs to get rid of them. Of course, if Jack simply grabbed all 24 bombs in a stage, he would get a pathetic score. A real superhero would get the bombs in the order in which their fuses lit up for massive bonuses. Like those pots with letters in Arabian. As tradition dictated, in Bomb Jack, enemies did kill Jack on contact, so cruising between the explosives was not so easy. There were only two enemy types, though. Okay, one of them could transform into a few varieties, depending on the stage, but still, only two. The enemies were not the selling point. The point was guiding Jack through 16 screen layouts with different arrangements of bombs, walls, and platforms, including a swastika stage set in Egypt, and all this to licensed music. And what would really draw people in were Jack's jumping mechanics, because proper aerial controls were in. The joystick could be used to move in mid-air, and tilting the stick up let you jump higher. Also, tapping the jump button while airborne made Jack stop his superhero ascent immediately, and tapping the button some more made Jack float down instead of dropping like a rock. So, Bomb Jack expected of players precise jumping to get the bombs in sequence and dodge the enemies, but unlike most similar titles, the player was in control at all times during gameplay. And we've got a whole set of these games by now. Jump Bug, Joust, Major Havoc, Bomb Jack. Hey, what's up with the letter J? Before we continue the story of jumping in Japan, let's go to another island, Britain, where we've also got a new company to greet. In 1982, one Tim Stamper, his girlfriend Carol Ward, his brother Chris, and their shared friend John Lethbury started their own company. It was called Ashby Computers and Graphics, since the gang was based in a town with a simple English name, Ashby de la Zouche. At that point, the marvelous Stamper brothers had had some experience with the arcade industry already. They had developed conversion kits and brand new games for other companies, not only locally, but internationally too. Reportedly, their clients included Konami, but of course this is happening when no one gets the credit for anything, especially in Japan, so it's no wonder Tim and Chris were trying to plot their own course. Ashby Computers had barely started arcade-related operations when the Stampers noticed something. Firstly, the British microcomputer market was growing explosively. Secondly, one of the best-selling models in Britain was the new Sinclair ZX Spectrum. Unlike many other micros of the day sporting a MOS 6502, the Speccy was equipped with a Zilog Z80. The Z80 also happened to be the workhorse of the Japanese arcade industry at the time, so the team was intimately familiar with its workings. Where other would-be Speccy game developers had to stumble through BASIC, Ashby Computers and Graphics could deliver unrivaled, fast and efficient low-level code. A change of the business plan was in order. In 83, the team unveiled its first Speccy games under the trade name Ultimate in big letters, Play the Game in smaller letters below. Being a homegrown startup amidst a boom, Ultimate Play the Game got a lot of media attention. The developers gave a round of interviews, all business as usual. But then something weird happened. The Stampers had set on a pretty tight release schedule, and every member of the team was involved in the development work, so they had no time for more interviews or public appearances. And Ultimate went radio silent. Normally it would have been a PR disaster, but it turned out the crowds liked this enigmatic company that kept regularly leaving nice, affordable games in the shops. Not talking to the press much became the standard procedure, since it generated a buzz of speculation for exactly zero effort. Even Ultimate's new product announcements could be just a sheet with game covers, titles, and a recommended retail price. Unfortunately, this intentional obscurity also spread into attribution, so there was no clear record of who was responsible for what in which game. This makes Ultimate Play the Game a fascinating research subject for a historian like Jimmy Marr, and he's got a big article piecing the rumors and interviews together on the Digital Antiquarian. Mind, Ultimate was not the most secretive studio of the time. Just wait until we get to the adventure games supposedly made at St. Bride's School. That one was pure performance art. Anyway, Ultimate could have entered the story last time because the gang's very first release title was Jetpack, without the K. It was another joust-like game. You got a side view of a wraparound arena with ground at the bottom and three platforms hanging above. But instead of a flying ostrich rider, you controlled Jetman, who could boost up using a rocket pack. Obviously, the player could control Jetman even while airborne, and the movement was really fluid, which helped a lot, as the goal of the game was to move between the upper platforms, first to collect the pieces of Jetman's spaceship, and then the fuel for it. All this while flying alien enemies were streaming onto the screen, so you had to shoot them with your laser gun. Each stage had only one enemy type, but every stage this type would be different, and some were more annoying than others. Also, every few levels your spaceship fell apart, and you had to put together a new one, going from a rocket to a space shuttle to something futuristic, and so on. Still, Jetpack was a simple game, but that's exactly where the Ultimate team wanted it. It didn't take long to develop, ran smoothly on the cheapest Spectrum models, and could be sold cheaply. This applies to most of the early titles from the company. Simple product with the broadest possible appeal to establish some revenue stream. At the same time, the visuals were great, the programming quality was superb, and where more amateurish developers struggled with graphics and performance, stuff like Jetpack blew people's minds and raised their expectations of what the Speccy was actually capable of. When the very first Golden Joystick Awards were being handed out in the UK in 1983, Jetpack beat Manic Miner to Game of the Year, and Ultimate Play the Game was named Software House of the Year. In 1984, it was time to get more serious and put out more sophisticated product for more upmarket but still popular Spectrum variants. I'll talk about these games mostly in the episodes dedicated to action-adventure games, since that's what Ultimate was wowing the British scene with at this point. But there is one title that needs to be mentioned right now. Nightlore. Knight with a K. This is where the missing K from Jetpack went. If you go to the Wikipedia article about Nightlore, you will see it start excitedly talking about the game's influence, then the article begins to drool a little, and ultimately concludes by frothing at the mouth. Apparently, Nightlore was like the beginning of everything. No. Its main calls to fame are promoting isometric axonometric graphics and action-adventure games. As for the former, ever since Zaxxon had come out in late 1981, isometric games were slowly trickling out already. We've met Qbert, Marble Madness, Congo Bongo, Blue Max, Mad Crasher, and there were others. For example, in 1983, one Sandy White released Ant Attack for the Spectrum. It puts you in the shoes of either a boy or a girl trying to save the other character from the world of giant ants. The levels in this world were shown in an axonometric view, in monochrome to increase the resolution, and you could run in four directions and jump to hop onto blocks making up the terrain. The game started easy. You climbed over a fence, found your target, and ran back to the exit together. In later stages, the geometry would get complicated, so you might use the keys to switch the view to a different angle, and the giant ants would start to come after the characters trying to bite them. The only way to get rid of the giant ants was, as it is in real life, a supply of grenades you could throw in four directions. Ant Attack was a neat and memorable game for the time, but somehow Nightlore got way more attention. Many saw it as a masterclass in bringing this style of visuals to cheap micros, which massively expanded developers' design space, because it let them create three-dimensional games without leaving the comfort of 2D sprite-based graphics. As for launching action-adventures, again, Nightlore is kinda late for that, since those have been coming out regularly since 1980, with or without Nightlore. In fact, the same 1984, Japan got a very high-profile action-adventure title in the arcades. The Tower of Druaga, designed by Masanobu Endo, the Xevious guy. This time he was allowed to put as many secrets into his game as he wanted, and he did, and Japanese players loved it, taking notes, trading secrets, browsing zines for clues. In the West, where no one had caught the secrets fever yet, the Tower of Druaga failed instantly and is still put by some into lists of the worst or the most frustrating games of all time. But Nightlore did impress Western players. So much so that in 1984, Ultimate got Golden Joysticks in Game of the Year, Software House of the Year, and Best Programmer of the Year categories. It was wild to see a game with a large world made up of many isometrically displayed rooms, filled with traps and enemies you had to avoid, objects you could push, and items you had to gather to save your character from certain doom. In a way, it was like King's Quest, also released in 1984, but to play Sierra's latest, one needed a computer priced at over $1,000. A Spectrum cost a fraction of that, and nice games for it, like Nightlore, could be purchased for less than £10. And while I'm on the money question, Nightlore also looked and played fine on black and white TV sets, a feature many in Britain still appreciated in the mid-80s. What is of great relevance to us today is that one of the buttons in Nightlore's simple control scheme was the jump button, with two functions. If you tapped it, the character hopped forward, and if you held the button down, you would get a longer leap. Of course, you'd be doing all that jumping in 3D environments, like in Ant Attack, and you had a choice of which of the four cardinal directions to jump in. And sometimes you had to move some box around the room to jump onto it before jumping onto something else. Hey, box puzzles. So the game felt new and exciting even without featuring any combat. There were a few problems, though. Firstly, the reference shadow under the character that had first appeared in Zaxxon was just gone. Congo Bongo didn't have it either, but that one was fairly linear. The shadow would come back in later games because players needed it, but as of Nightlore, we're in a two steps forward, one step back situation. The controls were also an issue, and this one is not getting fixed at all. With isometric graphics, your cardinal directions are diagonals, and isometric arcade games use joysticks installed rotated 45 degrees just for that reason, but the new arrow keys on Micro's keyboards and the Famicom's D-pad were oriented orthogonally. Even working with the Spectrum in 1984, the crew at Ultimate Play the game probably realized that it was awkward, because by default, Nightlore offered the same control scheme as Ant Attack, what today would be called tank controls. Two buttons to rotate the character on the spot, and one to walk forward. The alternative control scheme, directional controls, the one that ends up being used by most isometric games, simply wanted the players to rearrange their brains to accept that pressing up meant walking up and to the left, right meant up and to the right, and so on. Though in some other titles, up meant up and to the right. Unless you play those games constantly, you needed some time to adjust. Although in the late 80s, chances were pretty high that you would be playing those games constantly. Ultimate itself dubbed the engine used to make Nightlaw the Filmation Engine, and proceeded to release four more games of the kind in 85-86, even upgrading the code to support scrolling. And of course, there were clones, direct and loosely inspired by the original, some had combat, some leaned heavy on puzzles, some got rid of jumping. This pattern of isometric action-adventure games was employed to make a whole mountain of titles, until people finally got sick of them by the beginning of the 90s. And even then, as late as 1994, you could still see a new isometric tangle of puzzles and action on store shelves. Mystic Towers. So, as I get back to talking about jumping athletic games primarily using a side view, keep it in mind that out there in the microcomputer lands, there is a mounting wave of isometric, technically 3D, jumping titles, clumsy and awkward, but running perfectly well even on the cheapest hardware. Meanwhile, Japan was being taken over by giant humanoid robots. They had appeared in Japanese sci-fi before, but after Mobile Suit Gundam, they stampeded onto TV screens in force. We'll be back to some of them, like Fang of the Sun Dogrun, later. I am far from expert, in fact I don't know anything about the subject, but it appears that the most famous anime from this period is Super Dimension Fortress Macross, which started airing in 82, but there were many others. And the Transformers line of toys and its promotional animated series were launched in 84. The creators of those shows and manga were experimenting with what the mecha were capable of, coming up with new twists and gimmicks and super weapons. The major repeating trends of the day appear to be robots that could transform into jets, because walking everywhere is boring, and mecha that could combine into an even larger, extra powerful robot for an epic showdown. Many kids and teenagers this mecha media was aimed at also spent time and money in video game arcades, so the robots invaded there too. Some developers had a license, most didn't, but it's not like that's ever stopped anyone. Of course, there was the big question of what kind of game should something about robots be. War games and interactive fiction are fine, I suppose, but not for most players. And this is where anime offered designers a major cop-out. Mecha transform into jets. Make a scrolling shooter with a jet. Just tell people it's a mecha. And that's how you get something like Volgaard, released in 84 by DB Soft on a few Japanese micros. It's a decent-looking game with parallax scrolling in the background, but the design decisions behind its gameplay are baffling, as I discovered when I tried it out. Even though Volgaard is advertised as a mecha title, you start flying a regular jet. Enemies appear, many of them are harmless, the difficulty ramps up very slowly, you shoot at them for a few minutes, it's pretty dull, then the word caution appears on the screen, the boss shows up, looking a bit like a Star Destroyer from Star Wars. Then the boss takes you out with its superior firepower, and you have to redo the entire level from the beginning. Because that's not how you're supposed to play. No, those few boring minutes in the run-up to the boss are intended to be even more tedious, because instead of shooting, you need to avoid enemies to build up an energy gauge at the bottom of the screen, which is expanded whenever you fire. When your energy level reaches certain thresholds, you first gain an extra jet flying behind you, then a third jet, and eventually the three transform and combine into the flying Volgaard robot. That slows you down and increases your frontal cross-section something like fivefold, so forget about evading anything, but at least you no longer die in one hit. Attacks simply deplete some of your regenerating energy bar. This lets you deal with the boss, and then the game restarts at a higher difficulty. And that's Volgaard. Don't shoot anything for 5 minutes, kill the boss, repeat. I get what they were going for, tactically holding back to build up strength for a strike at a critical target, but it turns out that what works as a tense moment in a TV show is a touch boring to play. Yet the game was popular enough to warrant a Famicom sequel in 1985. For a more action-packed mecha game of 84, let's better look at the Formation Z cabinet from Jaleco, released in America by Williams as Aeroboto. This one is an arcade scrolling shooter, so it's far prettier, and most importantly, it starts with you running at the enemy in a humanoid robot armed with a gun. And if you tilt the joystick up or down, you can aim that gun a bit and fire at a 45-degree angle up to deal with flying enemies, and a 45-degree angle down to deal with nothing really, but you could jump and then fire down to take out tiny enemies too short to be hit by your regular shots. You can also hold down the fire button to charge up your gun to fire stronger shots that pierce enemies. And if you hold down the jump button instead of tapping it, your robot jumps higher, and if you don't let go of the button, it soars in the air and transforms into a jet, which boosts the scrolling speed, and is the only way to cross wide stretches of water or space you could not possibly jump over. Flying over all your troubles is pretty tempting, but as everyone knows from Scramble, to fly you need fuel, so your time as a jet is always limited. There are fuel power-ups you can collect, but better save the transformation for when you need it. Although in the end, Formation Z gives up on running and turns into a regular scrolling shooter set in space. While neither Volgaard nor Formation Z are exactly the kind of game we're talking about today, they will become very relevant come 1985. Also, Formation Z adds to our collection of titles experimenting with the jump button. None of them are quite as extreme as Amidar's Inverted Jump or Joust's Free Flying, but Major Havoc, Bombjack, Nightlaw, and Formation Z demonstrate that developers are not content with a key that simply makes a character move in an arc. What if it can control the length and height of jumps? What if it does something else when you're in the air? There are so many options to consider. Since I've veered slightly off the main topic, let's take a brief look at one more adjacent game, because it is actually going to put us right back on track. In 1984, IREM released another arcade classic designed by Takashi Nishiyama, the designer of Moon Patrol. This new title was an officially licensed movie tie-in game in Japan, but for the West it got rebranded and re-released as Kung Fu Master. It was not a game where you hopped over things much, but a game where jumping was necessary to perform certain attacks against rude dudes assaulting the main character, Thomas, as he was trying to rescue his kidnapped girlfriend. There was a story and several levels with a different boss at the end of each, and lots of pathetic goons to punch and kick on the way to the boss. Kung Fu Master is an influential title in the evolution of games about dudes and not only dudes punching each other in the face, and we'll talk about those more in the next episode. What's important at the moment is that there was this game about a guy kicking his way through villains to save his girlfriend, and this cabinet was doing so well in arcades that Nintendo wanted some of that. So a Famicom port would be developed at Nintendo under the direction of Shigeru Miyamoto himself. Say, what is the Mario gang up to in 1984? Well, the gang was gearing up for a rapid succession of jumping games it fired off in the autumn. But it could not do it alone. Nintendo had this funny problem in 83-84. It needed more games for the Famicom, because the launch offerings were dire, third-party publishers hadn't been invited yet, and the company itself barely had anyone who knew how to program for the 6502 it had picked for the processor. And to make it worse, the predominant processor type in Japan was the Z80, a completely different chip, so not many could help Nintendo dig itself out of its self-made hole. Except for this one small engineering game-developing outfit, which had worked with several Commodore systems before, and as the result had more experience with the 6502 than all of Nintendo put together. HAL Laboratory. So, HAL and Nintendo started working very closely, not as two separate companies. You'd see Shigeru Miyamoto directly telling his ideas to HAL programmer Satoru Iwata. That's how they made Golf for the Famicom. Decades later, after Iwata had become the CEO of Nintendo and after he died in 2015, when Nintendo released its first new system since Iwata's passing, the Switch, in 2017, fans were able to find an Easter egg in the console's firmware. An emulated version of Golf. It was next to impossible to run, and then got removed at the end of the year. The likely explanation is that golf was included as a good luck charm, omamori. They have a prayer inside, but are not supposed to be opened, and those charms' powers run out at the end of the year, so they are disposed of. Yes, Nintendo used some of the first code Iwata had written for the company as a prayer. The future is here. I wish they had blessed the detachable controllers too. Anyway, another game Satoru Iwata programmed in 84, working with Nintendo's graphics designer Yoshio Sakamoto, was Balloon Fight. Unlike Mario Brothers, where to find influences of Joust you have to analyze the gameplay in more abstract terms, Balloon Fight was an obvious Joust clone. Its original version, a versus system cabinet, offered one or two players to take to the skies as balloon fighters and clean up a big arena populated by some balloon birds. That is, birds flying by the means of a balloon, and if you pop the balloon by ramming the bird from above, the bird parachuted down to one of the many platforms and would start pumping its balloon back up again. That's when you had to ram it again to take it out. Balloon fighters themselves had two balloons and could flap their outstretched arms to float up. So it was Joust with a few twists, but the silly visual style and the music definitely helped Balloon Fight to stand out. In 85 there would be a Famicom version programmed separately, and since then Nintendo has kept remaking and re-releasing Balloon Fight whenever it had the opportunity. Another versus system game that reached arcades in the autumn of 84 was Ice Climber. While its two protagonists were armed with massive mallets for smashing ice to pieces, the game failed to break new ground. If anything, it was a retread of some old ideas, perfect for those who like swinging the hammer in Donkey Kong and the ice physics in Mario Brothers. What? Nobody likes ice physics? Well, programmers do. And for one Kazuaki Morita, Ice Climber was his first release title out of a long line of Nintendo classics. Ice Climber put one or two players in the warm shoes of stereotypical Inuit-looking characters Popo and Nana, whose general backstory and relationship ended up being so poorly outlined, the definitive statement that they're really close childhood friends would only come in 2001. Popo and Nana went out to a tall mountain swinging their hammers to get back some delicious vegetables stolen by a condor, or a butterfly depending on the game version. To get to the thief perched at the very top, the players had to jump up levels of icy blocks and surprisingly solid clouds. Fortunately, the hammers could be used to break the ice above you to create new openings to jump into. Unfortunately, the climb was still pretty long, the levels scrolled vertically, and you had to deal with jumping onto moving clouds and ice making you slip in one direction like a conveyor belt and cute hostile animals trying to attack you. Also, while scrolling was not forced like in a shooter, if you did spend too much time without advancing upwards, a polar bear wearing a pair of shades and red swimming trunks and nothing else would walk across the stage and stomp on it, forcing the screen to shift up one level. And that could take you out of the picture in every sense. As for the jumping physics, we've got a nice jump sound. The character's movement when they jumped mattered a lot, but players also got a very limited ability to adjust their jump arc in the air. You could hop straight up through a hole in the ice, shift a little, and land on the edge. Ice Climber was a decent game for the day, and like most stuff coming out on the Versus system late in 84, the game got ported to the Famicom in 85, and to the new American NES as well. Except the people at Nintendo of America looked at Ice Climber and noticed that Popo and Nana were using hammers to fight off hungry animals, and those animals included seals, so the US branch asked Nintendo to maybe cut it out with the seal clubbing, and so the seals were removed from the American release. Well, apart from the Nintendo seal of quality on the cover assuring buyers that NES games were not low-quality crap. But wait, Nintendo is not done surprising us in 1984 yet, because the same autumn it released another new Famicom title, Excitebike. The project was directed by Shigeru Miyamoto, who directed programmer Toshihiko Nakagawa to make him a side-scrolling game about motocross. Just like in Stunt Cycle 8 years earlier, there was no jump button. You had to ride up ramps to go airborne. But there wasn't really much incentive to do so on its own, because the game was all about reaching the end of the track fast, and jumping slowed you down a little. But often you did need a good jump to get over other obstacles that would have otherwise slowed you down even more. For controls, you had the classics. You could go fast, you could go faster, and the only thing stopping you from riding full speed all the time was that your engine would overheat and force your rider to take a break. You could also shift between the four lanes of the track, which helped if you wanted to steer around smaller pits of sand or computer opponents littering the screen in one of the two game modes. That's pretty old too. New here were these small arrows on some lanes you could ride over, and they magically cooled down your engine. Another novelty was the ability to shift your rider's weight forwards or backwards. On the ground, it lets you do a wheelie to ride smoothly over small bumps, kinda like in the Stunt Cycle console of old, because both games are modeling the same sport. Excitebike also let you do it in the air. Leaning forward made your jumps longer, shifting back made them higher. And you wanted to touch down with both your wheels to avoid losing speed. So even if the jumps could be pretty big, the player always had something to do. And if the player was bad at doing that something, and the bike hit the ground at a wrong angle or collided with one of the computer riders, the reward was a spectacular cartwheel, like the one in Digital Daredevil, and then the rider would fly off to the side of the track, and buttons had to be mashed like in some track and field to get back on track faster. And that was the whole game. Learn the track, jump well, don't crash too much, and try to show a good enough time to qualify for the next stage. It wasn't a groundbreaking improvement on the ancient multi-lane scrolling racing game formula, but it was fun enough, and the presentation was pretty good for the day. And of course, Excitebike shipped with a built-in What You See Is What You Get track editor you could use to challenge your friends with devious homemade gauntlets. It wasn't a particularly powerful editor, you simply assembled a track out of a set of pre-made obstacle sections. But you know, in the summer of 84, the Famicom port of Lode Runner had come out with an editor, and it was selling like hotcakes, and Nintendo likes money. And Excitebike did bring Nintendo money. But even more importantly, the project helped its developers gain experience, and its smooth, scrolling game engine could be reused in other titles, like the 1985 Famicom port of Kung Fu Master, and other stuff. Our tour of 1984 would be missing something important, though, if we also didn't get a peek at Namco. Late in 84, designer Tsukasa Nigoro taught Pac-Man how to jump. Yes, Pac-Man, the hero of the flattest game out there. As many decently successful video games of the period, Pac-Man got an animated series, and it in turn turned out successful enough for Nigoro to be asked with developing a game based on the series, based on the game. It's not the last time such a silly thing happens. Tsukasa Nigoro and his team could not use the old top-down perspective, since it would have looked nothing like the cartoon. So they went with a side view, and programmers and engineers did their best to put together a new engine and a system board that could handle a decently animated main character and colorful scrolling backgrounds. The system board would be reused in a number of other games in 84-85. As for this new game, titled Pac-Land, it was a fairly simple affair. Pac-Man started at one end of a level, a long strip set in a city or a castle or a forest or in the mountains, and you had to get to the other end within a time limit. Some levels were mostly flat, castles had several floors to hop between, some areas featured lakes you had to fly over by jumping onto a springboard, and there was even a level you had to traverse at night. The screen was dark, save for a cone of light coming out of Pac-Man's eyes. All along the way, you'd be assaulted by the prankster ghosts driving cars, flying airplanes, hopping on pogo sticks, and generally making a nuisance of themselves. One ghost always trailed behind Pac-Man to hit him if the timer ran out. Some of these threats could be countered by power-up items like a helmet, the classic power pellet let you chase and eat all the ghosts, and there were plenty of bonus items that only brought you points. Naturally, the best stuff was hidden away in secrets. Jump on top of something here, push a fire hydrant there. How does one push a fire hydrant? If you had the time, you could backtrack freely, but after walking to the left a few steps, you'd see a huge flashing arrow pointing to the right. No game, I'm not lost. I'm looking for secrets. I'd call the controls of Pac-Land unconventional, but this period was too experimental to expect any consistency. The controls were inspired by track and field. Tsukasa Nigoro gave you three buttons: left, right, and jump. Simple, but if you wanted to go faster in any direction, you had to keep tapping the direction button. Going faster made your jumps not only longer, but higher too, good for reaching secret spots. Jump height was also controlled by the length of the jump button press, but that alone wouldn't get you as high as a running jump. So, Pac-Man had something interesting going for it, jumping-wise, kinda like Alley Cat, except the control scheme involved lots of tiring tapping. If only someone remade this idea in an enjoyable way. With this, we finally advance to 1985, the year when Super Mario Bros. Was released, after a few other games which ultimately make Nintendo's classic slightly less of a big deal than it might seem today. Speaking of ultimately, if you remember, in 1985 the British micro market crashed, so how is Ultimate Play the game faring? Not so well, but that can't be blamed entirely on the crash. The Stampers had run out of ideas. The Filmation games the company was cranking out had become stale and samey pretty much instantly, the team could not squeeze any more performance out of the Speccy, and the contractors hired to do ports to other systems weren't as skilled. As a consequence of all of this, in 1986, Ultimate would be sold off to a British publisher of mainly American software, US Gold. But when US Gold people took stock of what they just bought, they discovered that Ultimate Play the Game was a carefully hollowed-out shell with a still recognizable brand, a few dated intellectual properties, and not much else. That's because the Ashby gang had a plan B. Right here in 85, the Stampers, which now included Tim's wife Carol, congratulations, founded a new company, Rare. Rare got established with the goal to master a new and likely profitable platform, the Famicom. The console was getting traction in Japan, games for it had a chance to sell millions of copies like in the good old days, and the hardware was more powerful, with lots of untapped potential. Of course, the programmers had to step out of their comfort zone to master a new processor architecture and reverse engineer the whole console, because they didn't have a development kit, nor even the most basic documentation, nor a license. This R&D work required money, which was perfectly legally siphoned off from Ultimate, something US Gold didn't need to know about. Then, whatever it was making, Rare naturally could not release anything on the NES or Famicom without Nintendo, but the Stampers had connections and got an audience with the head of Nintendo of America, Minoru Arakawa. He was sufficiently impressed by the demos, and from 1987 on, Rare titles would be published by Nintendo, beginning a long and productive partnership. This is where we'll put Rare aside, but we'll be back, maybe even to some of the Ultimate output. Both of the Stampers companies have released many titles impressive from the technical standpoint, and several fun games as well. Going back to actual games actually released in 85, we've got another new Japanese company to introduce, Game Arts. Yet more of those arts names. One of its founders was Kohei Ikeda, also known as Hibiki Godai, a nickname he picked because he thought his regular name was too boring, and Ikeda founded Game Arts after working on games at ASCII Corporation, as was the rest of the Game Arts crew. To operate, the new joint needed to release a product, and fortunately the development of its very first title is something covered in a few interviews, including ones translated at Shmuplations. Two Game Arts designers, Ikeda and Satoshi Uesaka, started thinking up a game for the new PC-88 Mark II. The game needed to be fun and profitable. They noticed that kids were amped about transforming robots, so that would be the theme. Scrolling seemed to be in fashion, but very few microgames offered it the way players liked it, fast and smooth, so the programming efforts would be focused on that. Finally, they planned to add some new elements to make the title stand out more. And as Uesaka says, "Also, we saw a certain not-to-be-named transforming robot game and thought, that's not how you do it. That was another inspiration." End quote. I think we can make a reasonable guess that the unmentionable game was Volgard, because that's what I said too when I realized what it wanted from me. The brainstorming and design work took Ikeda and Uesaka about a month, and in another month the game was done. Game Arts released it already in April 85, under the name Thexter, also known as Tegza to its Japanese fans. Thexter put the player in control of a mecha that could transform into a jet, But unlike in a certain unmentionable game, you could switch modes at any moment with a press of a button. And being a jet didn't even cost you any fuel, as it had Information Z. The fuel was on the house. Sure, with Thexter's levels being set inside various facilities and caves, there wasn't much room to spread your wings, but the jet had a smaller hitbox and could squeeze into openings too large for the robot. For weapons, you had just some particle beam gun. In jet mode, it fired in whatever direction the jet was facing, which could be useful for poking holes in walls and looking for secret rooms. In robot mode, the gun was more peculiar. When you held down the fire button, it automatically aimed and shot beams at any enemies in front with perfect accuracy. That was great because nearly all enemies in the game were tiny flying drones that usually operated in swarms, like bats, so the beam gun served as an excellent fly swatter. But also it kinda turned Thexter into a thinking player's action game, since your accuracy in fights did not depend on your reflexes, and the trick often was in luring drones into choke points where they couldn't surround you on all sides. Firing the gun cost you energy you had a limited supply of, but being touched by enemies drained the same energy meter even faster, and when it hit zero, the game was over. You recovered the energy by destroying drones, some types had more juice than others, and you could also get a free 100-point refill when you beat a level. If that sounds familiar, that's because the basis of the health system was borrowed from Theseus, along with a general gameplay of exploring mazes and occasionally dealing with locked doors. I even suspect that the name Thexter and Texar, starting with the same characters as Theseus, both in English and Japanese, was either a nod or an attempt to appear close to the older and similar game in some list or catalogue. There's more connection between the two titles. Ikeda had been thanked in the credits of Theseus, and its programmer was working with Game Arts in its early years, without being an employee officially. Anyway, another way to use your energy meter was not to wait for the enemies to hurt you, but pay 10 points to activate a shield in advance. It would stay on for a while, absorbing hits far more efficiently than stopping them with your nose. However, there was an extra price to pay. By using the shield, you forfeited that 100-point energy refill at the end of all levels. In addition, every time you beat a level, Thexter would get an extension of its maximum energy. You started with 100 points, clearing a level with a shield added 10 points, doing it buck naked added 30. Now, the possible maximum energy was capped at 500 points, so eventually this would stop being a factor, but still, if you wanted to survive the whole game, and maybe even see the second cycle with more dangerous enemies, you'd have to learn to start without the extra protection. As you must have noticed, so far I've been talking about the resource management aspect of the game instead of jumping. Well, it's because jumping's been figured out quite well at this point, and Thexter used what had worked in Theseus and Major Havoc. Also, the ability to turn into a jet and fly over things definitely made precise hops between safe platforms less of a priority. But that doesn't mean the game was easy. The levels were spelunkerish, large and split. You could go off the correct path, get cornered, and there were no extra lives to try again if you failed. Now, off the beaten path, you could also find clusters of energy-rich enemies, or maybe even secret characters fully refilling your supply, and those looked particularly silly. One of the secret sprites was a tiny space battleship Yamato. But on the whole, the game was tough, and the developers knew it. When you got to the final level, there was no boss fight. Just the enemy reactor you've been looking for, waiting for you to press the fire button and let your beam rip it to shreds. You've earned it. And then the game started over. When Thexter got released in the spring of 1985, this methodical, very different and nicely animated action game instantly put Game Arts in the spotlight. Thexter was a bestseller not only among the PC-88 titles, but thanks to a number of ports that came out the same year, in the entire Japanese microcomputer scene. The super important Famicom port was published by some company called Square, and it was Square's very first Famicom release. Unfortunately, it was developed for Square by Bit Laboratory, the same company that would soon crank out the fairly terrible Famicom port of David Crane's Ghostbusters. In 85, Bit Laboratory could code even less than in 86, especially as they were being rushed, so Thexter's cool beam weapon got replaced by a gun shooting pellets. Unlike beams, pellets could easily miss at long range, so enemy groups had to be revised, and so did map layouts in a few places. In any case, the Famicom version was never released on the NES in the West. Neither were any of the other ports, until... In 1986, the troubled ship of Sierra Online was back up on a steady course, no longer sinking and on fire at the same time. And so Ken Williams went to Japan to pick up some games for American distribution. He had already been to Japan. In fact, in 84, he brought a Famicom to Sierra offices, the team checked it out, agreed that it was a promising system indeed, but games for it had to come on cartridges, and Sierra Online had just been nearly crushed to death by a warehouse of unsold carts, so the decision was made not to develop for the Famicom or the NES. Sierra would make do with micros. Luckily, microcomputer games in Japan were booming, and, interested in big sellers no doubt, Ken Williams struck a really productive deal with Game Arts, thanks to which American audiences saw a whole bunch of games they might have missed out on otherwise. Localized ports of Thexter came out in 87, and these ports were not programmed at Sierra, but at Synergistic Software, the outfit we know for Odyssey, the complete app venture. Thexter was received well in America too, but a bit too late to make much of an impact, and of course it lacked the exposure an NES version could have provided. But in Japan it was a classic, and Game Arts would not only create sequels and remakes, but use the engine in a few of its other games in the 80s. But we'll leave those aside for now, as from the spring of 1985 we advance into the summer. Summer is the time for the hottest arcade releases, and a chance for yet another middling, mostly unremarkable company to get noticed and become the talk of the town. This season's lucky winner is Capcom. Well, okay, it had already been making waves with 1942 and another game we'll get to in a few episodes, but its summer hit was huge. Capcom, the half-sister of IREM, same founder, remember, had been around for some years as IRM, and people barely noticed it. But then it got this new name, Capcom, started hiring, and got really lucky by snatching former Konami developers, including one Tokuro Fujiwara. He was showing some promise. At Konami, he had designed Rock and Rope, that game with harpoons and cavemen, and he also created Puyan, a shooter where you controlled a mama pig moving up and down in an elevator while firing her bow at wolves coming for her kids by dropping from a tall tree branch holding balloons to soften the landing. In other levels, the wolves were ballooning upwards, and mama pig tossed meat of unspecified origin at them. That is a game that exists, and Puyan is even a Konami classic. But apparently Konami did not put enough effort into keeping its talent, so just like a few of his colleagues, Fujiwara joined Capcom. And at Capcom, Tokuro Fujiwara got a wild idea, sometime in 84 I guess. He wanted to make a game about demons. He even picked a name, Makai, World of Demons. But then he thought about it and decided to add a touch of whimsy by slapping Mura, village, at the end. Makai was menacing, but Makai Mura made you think, oh, really, there's a demon world village? What's the infrastructure like? Are demon chickens free range? And other silly things. Sadly, the Western name of the game would stimulate the imagination far less. It was simply Ghosts and Goblins. And so Ghosts and Goblins would be developed setting and demons first. Here, Tokuro Fujiwara and his team were drawing inspiration from a source nearly untapped by the Japanese video game industry of the day, European mythology. They got some books, albums of classical art, possibly architecture, anything they could get their hands on, and combed through the material for cool-looking designs that the team could imagine in motion and then animate with the hardware they had. They weren't quite the first in this. As we already know, at the time, Western computer role-playing games had started seeping into Japan, and they used a lot of monsters from classical sources. Also in 84, the Tower of Druaga featured knights in plate armor, lizard men, and dragons, because Masanobu Endo was borrowing from an edition of Dungeons & Dragons he had picked up on a trip to America. Also in 84, Nintendo released Devil World for the Famicom. It was 90% a shameless clone of Pac-Man, but the playing field scrolled all the time, so you could get crushed near the edges. The direction of scrolling changed too, and you'd be warned about it by the dance of a demon in red swimming trunks at the top of the screen. Oh, and the power-up pellets were replaced by Bibles, which let you shoot fire, obviously. That was a game too, and created under the direction of Shigeru Miyamoto. Of course, when Nintendo of America people saw it, they refused to publish Devil World. But it did come out in Europe eventually. By the way, the game was programmed at a small contractor studio founded to help Nintendo with porting and making new Famicom titles, but eventually the studio would start creating original games too, so let's get its name out there. Intelligent Systems. Meanwhile, back at Capcom, Tokuro Fujiwara and the crew created the very first character to inhabit their Demon World village. It was a fairly generic-looking demon by European standards. A red-winged gargoyle. They called him Red Arima, because he looked kinda like their programmer, Toshio Arima, and he, the gargoyle, would embody everything Ghosts and Goblins was about. But there were other enemies too, including a big novelty in video games, zombies that came out of the ground. There were also skulls that rose into jumping skeletons, there were various ghosts, free-range crows, bats, and big demon dudes wearing red swimming trunks. No, I don't know why we've already got three games today with enemies wearing red Speedos. I blame high fashion. Although there most likely is a source of inspiration for this. All these assorted demons, spirits, the living dead, and crows would be encountered in cemeteries, caves, and decaying palace and castle interiors. But encountered by whom? By some knight named Arthur, who came to the cemetery with his love, Princess Prin, and undressed in front of her, as people usually do in cemeteries. But that's when a flying Satan with a stylish purple cape appeared and kidnapped the princess. So in the opening cutscene, Arthur dons his suit of armor, and from that point on, you have control. Well, not too much control. Fujiwara used the old style of jumps with no mid-air adjustments. He liked his games hard, and the jumping mechanism definitely demanded precision, both in evading enemy projectiles and leaping between platforms over pits of certain doom. Well, you could dodge projectiles and crows by ducking under them, like an elevator action, but that came with its own complications. If you wanted to take enemies out, though, Arthur had weapons, and all of them were thrown projectiles in infinite supply. You started the game with the lance Arthur was about to show to Prin before the kidnapping, but many demons carried pots, and new weapon power-ups could fall out of those pots. So the lance could be replaced by a faster dagger, also thrown straight forward. Or you could get an axe that would fly in an arc. Or you could get a torch that would fall on the ground and create a patch of fire that damaged all enemies walking into it, kinda like the dragon attacks in Ninjakun. And then there was the cross, which naturally had to be censored for the American release, and the cross seemed like a very weak, short-ranged weapon, because it was. However, it was the only thing that could hurt the final boss, and if you dared to reach the big fight without the cross, the game would just go nope and force you to redo the entire final stage. And that was only the beginning, because once you beat the final boss, the game would inform you that it was merely an illusion and a trap laid for you by Satan, but it's an easy mistake to make, because the boss, Astaroth, was wearing a red robe with white fur elements. No red Speedos, at least. So when you beat him once, it was not the end. To rescue Princess Prin, you had to go through the entire game again, only on the second cycle the enemies were a bit faster. And there were no pushovers to begin with, especially Red Arima, who took several hits to take down, and preferred to stay back out of range, swooping at Arthur when you least expected it. You might think it was a boss, but no, they were regular enemies. I suspect this is the beginning of some kind of tradition among Capcom developers to surprise players with extremely challenging, ordinary baddies. Take Devil May Cry from 15 years later. The first time you run into a shadow, you'll probably die, and you'll keep dying to these spectral cats until you relearn how to move and fight. And then you begin to like it, because predictable foes that home in on you or swing something once in a while are fine, but bland, and you gotta have something spicier. Adding to the heat level of Ghosts and Goblins was that Arthur could not take attacks too well. Just one hit from anything would make all of his armor pop off and leave the hero in his boxes. It's like he was actually a stripper hired by Prin. This explains everything. So once Arthur lost his protective shell, another hit would kill him. The game was not quite so brutal as to demand the players beat the Great Satan twice with only 2 hit points. Arthur got the suit back at the start of each stage, and there were a handful of armor pickups in the levels. But they won't be coming from pots. No, you had to look for secrets in dangerous places. Ghosts and Goblins was difficult, and even making it easier for yourself required extra effort. You'd lose a lot. But you would come back. And among the reasons why, you could name the tough but fair gameplay, the humor, the novelty of the gothic horror setting, the curiosity of what there was just beyond the last screen you'd managed to reach, and the music. The game's soundtrack was composed by Ayako Mori, and she was one of the first professional composers Capcom bothered to hire when in 1984 the company tried to make its games sound better. It succeeded, but Ayako quit already in 1986, right after saying at a roundtable interview for Beep magazine that game designers knew nothing about music, so their demands were annoyingly vague and she had to come up with 7 or 8 songs based on requests like
The Sea.
And then her work got rejected with no adequate explanation. See, it's not enough to hire specialists, you also need to know how to talk to them. In spite of these communications issues, when Makaimura appeared in Japanese arcades in the summer of 85, it was an instant hit. That autumn, Ghosts and Goblins made it to the United States, also to a warm reception. In 86, the Famicom and NES ports were published, about a year after their respective arcade originals, and these two were bestsellers. Europe needed a special approach, so the same year, Amstrad and Spectrum ports were released by British company Elite Systems. And these ports were well received enough for Elite to get a Golden Joystick as Software House of the Year 1986. The Commodore 64 and PC ports were crafted in the USA by one Troy Linden, who was a pretty busy contractor in the 80s, working with Activision and Lucasfilm and then EA at the end of the decade, and here in the middle he scored a deal with Capcom to port more than 10 titles. And there's more about the guy on his Moby Games biography page, and if you scroll down, you'll see one of the contributors is Troy Linden himself. So his current hobbies clearly include tooting his own horn, in addition to fundamentalist Christian game development. So in 85-86, Ghosts and Goblins was very noticeable, and of course it had to be turned into a franchise. It seems to have helped Capcom with talent issues as well, because when it announced the sequel, Dai Makaimura, it turned out the teams between the two games were almost totally different, but most of the sequel crew were fans of the original. That's why they'd come to Capcom, where the magic happened. Okay, they had one designer who hadn't even heard of Ghosts and Goblins when he joined, but peer pressure made him learn how to play and beat the game, and he loved it. Or so he says. The sequel, titled Ghouls and Ghosts in the West, came out in 88-89, offering more of slightly different but mostly the same action. And in a roundabout way, it's one of the origin points of the Sonic the Hedgehog franchise. We'll get to that some other day. Also, that gargoyle everything had started with, Red Arima, better known in the West as Firebrand, got its own spin-off series, Gargoyle Quest. And of course, there were games made by other companies, lifting the gothic horror setting, or some weapons, or both, like Castlevania, but today's not the day we talk about that. Because now, we need to advance from the summer of 1985 to the autumn, when Nintendo released Super Mario Bros. For the Famicom in Japan, and a month later, give or take, in the United States. It may have been an NES launch title in America, except the NES was only being sold in New York City at that point, so the details are sketchy. It was out there in the US in 86, that's for sure. Now, if you shop around, it's fairly common for histories of Super Mario Bros. Development to be presented either through the maturing of Shigeru Miyamoto as a game designer, or through the evolution of Nintendo's staff as a whole. But this is a different kind of show, Nintendo does not exist in a vacuum, so instead of gushing over Super Mario, we're going to see if there's anything at all it can surprise us with. The plot of Super Mario Bros. Is not going to be one of those new things. It's starring Mario again, and some at Nintendo did ask Miyamoto why he was using the same character so many times. But he liked the character, and Mario seemed suitable for many roles. In fact, his versatility would keep surprising Shigeru for decades. Though this time Mario wasn't really doing anything new, just another damsel in distress rescue operation. But he was moving up in the world, advancing from a three-umbrella Pauline to Princess Peach of a Mushroom Kingdom. Also, Mario Mario was bringing Luigi Mario with him, but they could not play cooperatively. They had to take turns trying to save the royalty. The princess was held in captivity because she was the only person in the kingdom able to resist and counter the magic of the boss of the invading turtle-like Koopa creatures, looking similar to turtle pests in the original Mario Brothers. Well, now they were attacking, and their king's evil magic had turned most inhabitants of the Mushroom Kingdom into plants and stones and bricks. Of course, when Nintendo of America localized Super Mario Brothers, Koopas became Koopas, and their king was given the name Bowser, making it the second jumping game with a main antagonist named Bowser after Alley Cat. As for Princess Peach, the Americans could not fathom that the Princess of Mushroom Kingdom would not be named after a mushroom, so the poor girl had to become Princess Toadstool. No one was thinking much about it, since neither the Japanese nor the American branch saw Super Mario Bros. As the start of a major franchise. There was no attempt to craft deep, consistent lore. They just needed something to get the game going. Both Shigeru Miyamoto and his co-designer Takashi Tezuka were working on other stuff in parallel to Mario's latest outing, the rest of the team were equally busy, and they had just finished Excitebike and that port of Kung Fu Master. Miyamoto discovered in the last minute that there was no one but him to draw the box cover art, and he did it, and the guy was so overworked the Bowser on the cover didn't even look like himself in the game. The original Bowser design was a bit of a mess, but Nintendo had a new guy to save the day, eventually, Yoichi Kotabe, an experienced artist and animator. They showed him the cover, the game sprite, Miyamoto told Kotabe he was inspired by an ox character from an anime, while Tezuka reminded them that King Koopa was supposed to be a turtle. And Kotabe was experienced enough not to break down in tears, but rather to listen to these ridiculous people and work out a functional design of an ox-headed turtle, the Bowser recognizable today. Yoichi Kotabe also did an editing pass over all other key character designs, creating the canonical Super Mario Bros. Look. But that happened after the original game had come out. Unlike the old Mario Bros., Super Mario Bros. Would not take place in a static single-screen arena. Firstly, players were getting sick of those. Secondly, after all the work done on Excitebike and the Kung Fu Master port, the team at Nintendo had a good idea how to make a nice-looking, smooth-scrolling Famicom game. So Mario could travel across the Mushroom Kingdom. Sometimes levels were set in the overworld, with white clouds in the blue skies, some levels ran underground, some placed Mario in castles full of fire and lava, and there were even a couple of underwater stages, but we've seen that in Jungle King and Jump Bug. By the way, Jump Bug beat Super Mario Bros. In that it could transition from one environment to another on the go, while for Mario to switch, say, from the overworld to the underworld, the Famicom's color palette had to be reset, so this was only done between levels or when Mario entered a pipe and the screen went black for a moment. Even though the game world was larger now, Shigeru Miyamoto stuck to the old Donkey Kong four-stage rhythm. Every fourth stage was a castle where Mario had to deal with Bowser, or more frequently, one of his minions, disguised as the boss. That, by the way, was something that appeared as a result of an accident. A programmer assigned a wrong sprite to defeated Bowser, which made him suddenly turn into a regular Koopa turtle. The designers looked at this and thought it was a neat twist, so now fake Bowsers are a staple of the franchise. But, unlike Miyamoto games of old, Super Mario Bros. Did not just repeat entirely every few levels. It had 32 different stages. It had to have many of those, because after the 50-stage load runner port from the year before had raised expectations, even Nintendo was obliged to meet certain standards set by third-party developers. And the team even surpassed them, because those were 32 scrolling levels, not individual screens, although they too were clearly built out of tiles. Another thing the new game had over load runner was that its levels were designed to be traversable by two different characters. Both a regular Mario and a Super Mario. Super Mario was a Mario on mushrooms. They were a power-up you could knock out of some blocks by hitting them from below, in a further development of that power block from earlier. The power-up acted kinda like the suit of armor in Ghosts and Goblins, in that it let Mario take one more hit before dying, but it was also much more. Super Mario grew twice as tall as a regular Mario, so he wouldn't fit into small openings, but when he jumped, his fist easily smashed brick tiles into bits, ice climber style, something simple Mario could only dream of. Wait, didn't Bowser's magic turn some of the Mushroom Kingdom inhabitants into bricks? Maybe Mario should lay off the shrooms. Strangely, Super Mario Bros. Was at least the second jumping game of 1985 where you changed your character's size by eating mushrooms. But I'll tell you about Alice in Wonderland some other time. There was another transformative power-up in Super Mario Bros., the Fire Flower. If Super Mario ate one of those, he became a Fire Mario and gained the ability to throw fireballs that bounced along the ground and took out enemies. They could even gun down Bowser. While ranged weapons in jumping games weren't exactly new, getting the ability in this one basically switched the game to easy mode until you took a hit. Compared to the regular ways of dealing with enemies, Fire Mario was like Indiana Jones drawing his gun on a guy with a scimitar. As for the regular ways of dealing with enemies, Super Mario Bros. Offered a combination of two things. The original Mario Bros., hitting enemies through platforms from below, and elevator action and Pac-Land, jumping on them from above. Well, they say that stomping on enemies part was inspired by all the fighting in Kung Fu Master and Miyamoto condensed it to the jumping, but elevator action did it first, and thinking about it a little more, Joust was very particular in that whoever was coming into a collision from above won. Also, Toru Iwatani, the designer of the original Pac-Man, has said in an interview that Miyamoto told him that Pac-Land had been an inspiration for Super Mario Bros., so that claim is also out there. Wherever they'd come from, both of Mario's attacks involved jumping, so might as well talk about it in this here jumping episode. The best way to characterize Mario's new jumping skills in audio form is this. Here is Ice Climber jump sound, and here's the Super Mario Bros. Jump sound. Almost the same. Well, that's how it worked mechanically too. The longer you pressed the button, the higher you jumped. Momentum still played a major role in defining the arc of the jump, but you could adjust it in the air, and in a more noticeable and satisfying way than the tiny nudge of Ice Climber. Now, I know I've been constantly bringing up aerial controls in jumping games for the past two episodes, but they do matter. Today, it is rare to find a title where you cannot adjust your trajectory mid-jump. If the game doesn't let you, it's usually because it's a puzzle where a fixed jump is a tool for dealing with specific kinds of obstacles. In all other cases, you want control. You intuitively try to control your fall, and the lack of it in early jumping games is a major reason they feel so obnoxious to a modern player. You press a button and then you just watch things happen on the screen for a second with no way to affect it, then you press the button again. But if you wanted to play something where you're not in control 50% of the time, you'd play, I don't know, chess? So we're seeing two solutions being worked out by game designers. One is to give the player something else to do, say shoot enemies like in Ghosts and Goblins. The other is to let players control the jumps, just like that, with no explanation, magical farts. Because it's more fun that way. Going back to Super Mario Bros., another quirk of the game was that now Mario jumped like Pac-Man too. One of the buttons on the controller made him run faster, and when Mario was sprinting, his jumps were not only longer, but higher as well. That's how you got Bowser, a running leap over the green monster onto an axe that fell, cut the bridge Bowser was on, and sent the boss into lava. Mario takes no prisoners. I suppose I should say a few words about the structure of the levels where all this jumping was taking place. They were long strips, like in Pac-Land. Mario moved to the right, your view scrolled to follow him, and you could never go back to the left, since the camera of Excitebike hadn't been programmed to scroll the other way. So forget about exploring freely like in Thexter, or even backtracking like in Pac-Land. That's not to say the Mario levels were perfectly linear. Even without vertical scrolling, there could be an upper path and a lower path, a path for a small Mario and for Super Mario, and there were secrets. It's a Japanese video game from 1985, of course there were secrets. They ranged from regular-looking bricks containing power-ups, to secret side areas you could enter by ducking into a random pipe, to special warp pipes that let you skip multiple levels and get to the end faster. But Super Mario Bros. Did not insist on players finding all its secrets the way the Tower of Druaga had. The secrets were a nice bonus, with one exception. The final level of the game, Bowser's Castle in the Eighth World, must have recycled some more code from Excite Bike, as it looped like a racetrack, and no matter how long you kept running to the right, you never got to the end. You had to figure it out that taking specific paths in certain areas broke the loop. Or you'd pick up a magazine to learn about the trick, or ask your parents to buy you one. You might be inclined to take the magazine route, because Super Mario Bros. Was long for a console game of its age. It would take you more than an hour to get to the end, and there was no way to save your progress, and if you got stuck and let the timer run down, Mario died, and you had to restart the level. Not sure why he died, of disappointment perhaps. By the way, have you noticed how these past two episodes have featured lots of timers in games? If you remember, in the late 70s, after Breakout and Space Invaders, timers were supposedly going out of fashion. But Space Panic came with its diegetic timer in the form of an oxygen meter, then Donkey Kong had its sugar-coated bonus timer, the coin-op industry loves all limits on session length, so timers are back and everywhere again. The timer put a lot of extra pressure on players in the final level of Super Mario Bros., and in general didn't let them search for secrets too thoroughly. But you wanted those secrets. The power-ups, the extra lives, and the coins. Yes, just like in the bonus levels of the original Mario Bros., you collected coins, why wouldn't you? They made a very satisfying sound, which I'm not going to play. See, around 2016, as various countries started to allow trademarking sounds, Nintendo rushed to apply, and this coin effect is now supposed to be used in titles endorsed, licensed, or produced by Nintendo. Anyway, in addition to the sound, players would want the coins for extra points, if they cared about those, and for more extra lives. Every 100 coins got you a spare Mario. We've seen this mechanism already as well, in Jump Bug. Another thing about the level design of Super Mario Bros. That is lauded more and more as years go by is how, in the very beginning, it gradually introduced a new player to its mechanics. The general idea that players needed to be eased into the action was already widely accepted by the industry, as even Defender held back in the first stage, so for about 20 seconds. But this new game took it a step further. Here's the first enemy. You won't get past until you learn to jump. Here's a gap between two piles of blocks. Jump over the gap. If you fail, it's not a problem. There's solid ground between the blocks. But next time, there will be a bottomless pit. A small lesson and a test. That's programmed learning. And it had been around for decades at that point. And it wasn't just video games that were getting it. In 1985, a tabletop war game was published, Pacific War, and its rulebook was written with programmed learning in mind, so instead of dumping the rules on the players all at once, it first explained how air missions worked, and with that you knew enough to play the first scenario, the raid on Pearl Harbor. Got it? Here's a lesson on naval battles, a scenario, on ground battles, a scenario, and lesson by lesson you got how the whole thing worked. So Shigeru Miyamoto is not quite inventing new things, but he's on the cutting edge of game design trends of his era, and he had been working hard to get there. If you remember, back in the original Mario Bros., he had used short scripted cutscenes to introduce and explain new enemies in the course of the game. And here, in Super Mario Bros., he found ways to engineer those educational situations so that they happened naturally in the course of gameplay. This made Super Mario Bros. A perfect first video game. And for many kids in America, it was. The NES was the first new major console in years, the new Mario was a launch title. As a result, for a whole generation, Super Mario Bros. Would be their first video gaming experience. And it would shape their perception of games with its mechanics, its levels, its characters, and of course, its music. The soundtrack of Super Mario Bros. And the coin pickup sound were composed by one Koji Kondo. He'd been given musical education at a very young age, when he could not say no yet to the piano lessons. At school, he rebelled and went through a rock phase, but then Koji discovered jazz and fusion and suddenly wanted to be a keyboard player. In the early 80s, he got into programming, sound synthesis, and felt really interested in the noises video game cabinets like Donkey Kong were making. In 84, Koji Kondo saw a job opening at Nintendo and applied. They hired him as the company's first game music composer, and put him to work on the Punch-Out cabinet. Though the cabinet was released in February 84, maybe Koji had joined earlier. But clearly, both Capcom and Nintendo were realizing that the key to good game music was in hiring real musicians instead of programmers at around the same time. Anyway, when Kondo was done with Punch-Out, they put him on the Super Mario Bros. Project, let him play some prototype versions and asked for 6 tracks. And working closely with designers, Koji Kondo delivered tracks so good, composers had to talk about it at that 1986 Game Music Roundtable interview, even though Koji Kondo wasn't there. Ayako Mori, not a fan of game music because of how primitive the hardware was, had to admit that the style of the main theme made it stand out. Another thing mentioned there was that Nintendo had already released 4 Mario music records in 86. And you can find at least one of those online, a vinyl with the in-game versions of the tune on the one side and an orchestral version on the other. Oh yes, Nintendo commercialized its game music early, and distinctive sound made it possible to advertise through new channels like the radio. So people know the tune now not just because they like it or the game, but also thanks to corporate marketing. Of course, when Koji Kondo was composing his now legendary tracks, he did what every composer does and borrowed a little from what he liked himself. There's plenty online about tracks that inspired Super Mario Bros. Music. In some cases, Kondo took the basic structure of pieces or common elements of a particular style, but there is also the curious case of the Underworld theme. It's got this pretty distinctive bass line, which happens to be a dead ringer for a track from a 1979 album Friendship by a band of the same name. The track's name basically sums up Nintendo's policy whenever it borrows something from others. Let's not talk about it. To sum it up, while to many American kids unwrapping their NESs and Super Marios in 85-86, the game was a bolt of lightning out of the blue, in reality it most certainly was not. Like Dungeons & Dragons that had blown the minds of the earlier generation, Super Mario Bros. Came from a combination of already existing threads. First of all, it's the broad industry trends of the period. Better approachability, more variety, more content, improved presentation, fancy pants scrolling. Secondly, it absorbed idiosyncrasies specific to the Japanese industry. The secrets fad is the main one. Thirdly, the game would not have been possible without years and years of work. Take Mario's jump alone. Its features had been worked out over Donkey Kong, Popeye, Mario Brothers, Ice Climber and Excitebike, and that's just Nintendo games. And there was also Joust and Kung Fu Master and Pac-Land and other titles that were not successful but demonstrated what you shouldn't do. Nailing satisfying jump physics was quite a journey. A good stretch of that journey took place when Americans were sick of buying video games, so most of them missed it, and the end result was a shock. Though most shocking to me is that Shigeru Miyamoto was drawing from games about motorbikes and gangs, and he didn't take the easy route of making something about biker gangs. And so, in September 1985, on Friday the 13th, Super Mario Bros. Hit the shelves in Japan. Micros already had Thexter, renovated arcade halls were booming with Ghosts and Goblins, and now the Famicom got its star. The game sold more than 1 million copies by the end of the month, September. So that's over 2 weeks and a bit. Those were decent sales figures. Okay, they were amazingly good. This is on par with pre-crash sales figures in America, and it was only the beginning. Super Mario boosted the sales of the console itself too. You had to get a Famicom for this. And now it's doubly impressive that the Famicom port of the Portopia serial murder case, released in November 85, managed to find 700,000 people not glued to the new Mario and buying other games. In the United States, thanks to the slow introduction of the NES, Super Mario Bros. Apparently only hit 1 million sales at the end of 86, so after the countrywide console release when the NES itself sold 1 million units. The system was great, but not 1 million people rushing to New York and Los Angeles to buy it great. Still, a console game reaching 7-digit sales figures in post-crash America was a clear sign that people still loved video games over there and were hungry for more, and Nintendo had basically no surviving competitors in this immense market. Oh, Sega's trying to come here? Just threatened shop owners that they wouldn't get any more Marios if they dealt with Sega. Problem solved. In addition to performing a CPR on the American video game market so well that even the old Atari 2600 started selling again, Super Mario Bros. Changed a few other things in the grand picture. Shigeru Miyamoto was fairly laid back with secrets. Japan loved them, but if Americans found them too annoying, the extras weren't crucial. You didn't have to find them all. And it must have triggered some contrarian spirit in America. I don't have to find them? Oh yeah, I'll show you. I will find them and I will like it. So 3 years after Japan, American video game fans finally started enjoying secrets. Mario helped bridge that gap. Of course, in Japan, the fad had started as a grassroots initiative by players trying to squeeze more fun out of Xevious, while in the US of A, kids would be praising Nintendo and Miyamoto. And secrets were a great way to break the ice between the company and the audience. Activision had done it with patches and bragging rights, but secrets and puzzles seemed to be a fairly common conversation starter in the 80s. Before widespread internet access, companies publishing adventure or role-playing games were expecting mail and calls with questions, and some preempted this and profited on it by publishing hint books or setting up help hotlines. It was a decent side hustle. People were willing to write, call, and pay money to deal with a puzzle that tormented them. That's how, early in 87, Howard Phillips Howard Phillips, established the first official fan club at Nintendo of America, Nintendo Fun Club, with a newsletter, and you guessed it, the first issue featured Super Mario on the first page, and the article next to the picture said you could get a book, How to Win at Super Mario Brothers, which is not available in bookstores, kids. You can only get a free copy for a coupon included with the mailing. Just a little over a year earlier, the same strategy guide had been successfully marketed in the Family Computer magazine in Japan, and they had the same publisher. Of course, in addition to the coupon offer, other pages would bombard children with ads, announcements, and more ads. In later issues, they explained what the Nintendo Seal of Quality meant, threw in high score challenges, crosswords, fan mail, score bragging, more ads. The newsletter was getting thicker and thicker, and in 88 they replaced it with a more professional magazine, Nintendo Power, taking after its Japanese predecessor in both format and purpose. So, officially sanctioned platform magazines are another thing Super Mario Bros. Gave a leg up to. But that's not all. The success of the game as an NES launch-adjacent title, its approachability and family-friendly style, meant that for the next decade or so, every console manufacturer thought it their duty to have a Mario-like game available around a new system launch. It would be a game everyone would buy or get with a console, even first-time players could get into them easily, and who knows, maybe the protagonist would become the brand's mascot. Many franchises came out of the great mascot rush of the late 80s and early 90s. Some of them even survived past a couple of installments. Those chasing after Mario's popularity and profits often had trouble with it. The team at Nintendo, and Miyamoto in particular, had years of pure experience making jumping work. They were experimenting, trying things in the games that were released, and even more so in the early versions that weren't. Koji Kondo says that after he'd composed the original theme for Mario, he had to go back and revise it later in development because the tempo of the whole game had changed, got faster. Shigeru Miyamoto and Takashi Tezuka knew like few others what every variable in a jump did, how it felt when you changed them or altered collision detection. And that's something that many trying to clone Mario lacked, at least in the early going. It didn't stop people from trying, especially in the European microcomputer scene, because Nintendo wasn't doing so well in Europe, and everyone into games already had a micro. But they knew about Super Mario, and may have even played it on the Versus system cabinet. In 1987, Time Warp Productions in Germany created The Great Gianna Sisters for the Commodore 64, which involved Manfred Trentz we've run into in the scrolling episode. Apart from the not-so-subtle similarity of the titles, The Great Gianna Sisters featured mushrooms on the cover, along with a girl doing something like Mario's jump pose. You took enemies out by jumping on them, there were 30-something levels, the beginning of the first one was nearly identical to the start of Super Mario Bros., and vaguely similar layouts kept appearing in later stages too. But it wasn't a complete rip-off, there were new power-ups, and the soundtrack was composed just for the game. Then something happened, which may or may not have involved Nintendo's lawyers, and the production of The Great Gianna Sisters abruptly ceased. Then it disappeared from store shelves because it reviewed well, and all copies got sold out. Luckily, there were pirate copies still. In 89, some fans even made a Gianna Sisters construction kit, a level editor. Now, I'm not going into more details of direct Super Mario clones, since they made up only a portion of games where you jumped across scrolling stages dealing with enemies in the late 80s. But I don't want to end abruptly on Super Mario Bros. Either, even though it was a big deal, and offered a successful model to copy. Athletic games get noticeably less experimental on a basic level from here on out. It's mostly about adding features. So let's have us a survey of post-Mario games about jumping and running, which still didn't have a catchy common name, and it was driving the press up the wall because now they had to write about them in every issue. 1986 was the year Tekken finally became Tecmo. The very first title released under the new name that spring was Mighty Bomb Jack for the Famicom. The superhero with perfect aerial controls was back, rescuing a royal family trapped in a pyramid. Also back were the bomb-collecting stages, only now they were bonuses to the main course. Large levels that scrolled vertically or horizontally, full of secrets and power-ups and enemies. Sure, you could hop through without bothering with all the extra nonsense, but then at the end you would only be able to rescue the king. For the rest of the family, you had to find and collect crystal balls. And for the best ending, you also needed secret coins. So good luck locating those hidden treasure chests and alternative level exits you'd open with Sphinx statues stashed nearby. We're going full secrets. The power-up system was also less straightforward than Mario's. Bomb Jack could collect mighty coins and use them to jack up with a press of a button. You wanted to because that was the only way to open some treasure chests, and hitting the peak, third level of power, turned all enemies on the screen into gold coins to collect. That's good, but power-ups wore off after a certain number of jumps and did not protect you from enemy attacks in the slightest, so keep an eye out for more mighty coins. But don't get greedy. If Jack ever stocked more than 9 coins, 9 lives, or 99 ticks on the level timer, he would be sent to the torture room, to get out of which you had to jump 49 times in an arena filling with enemies. The same spring, Sega introduced one of its long-running franchises, Wonder Boy, a System 1 arcade cabinet. Later in the year, Hudson Soft launched the first installment of its long-running series, Adventure Island, for the MSX and Famicom. And they were the same game. Yeah, a funny story happened. Wonder Boy had been developed for Sega by a new company called Escape. It was its first project. But by the terms of the contract, Sega owned merely the arcade version, the name and the characters, the stuff that was covered by copyright and trademark law. Escape shrugged and sold the game again to Hudson Soft, and Hudson ported the thing, replacing the content owned by Sega and adding a few trifles. Both games feature the guy trying to rescue a girl from the clutches of a boss, fought every 4 levels in 8 worlds. Both had a power-up that gave you a ranged weapon, an axe, and another power-up was a skateboard, granting speed and an additional hit point. So they're trying to mix things up not to be a boring Mario ripoff. Another addition was a vitality meter, meaning that the main character had to be fed over the course of levels, or he got tired and dropped dead. Hey, at least it's not the great timer in the sky that kills you. The same 1986, DB Soft, we know from that inspiringly terrible Volgard, released its own game of running and jumping across a landscape with forced scrolling. But I'll cover it if I do an episode about 80s titles trying to get sales through shocking content. DB Soft, working through its Pawn Games label, managed to produce something so awful it made not only the abandoned Damsel in Distress plots, but also Custer's Revenge look dignified by comparison. In the summer of 86, Nintendo released Super Mario Bros. 2 for the Famicom Disk System. The game was crafted under the leadership of Shigeru Miyamoto and Takashi Tezuka again, and they used the sequel to polish many points of the original, starting with the graphics. And they stopped pretending that there was a two-player mode and simply let the player pick either Mario or Luigi at the start. And for the first time, the jump physics of the bros were slightly different. The sequel refined and improved jumping physics in general, made bouncing off enemies' heads a viable jump on its own, added wind that affected jump arcs, and there was a new power-up, the Poison Mushroom, that acted like an enemy and could surprise players by popping out of a block when they were hunting for secrets. Of course, coming out months after the hugely successful Super Mario Bros., the sequel was tuned for the people who had played the original, maybe even beaten it, maybe even tried out the second cycle where everything was faster. There were millions of them in Japan, so it made perfect sense that the challenge level of the sequel was brutal at best and punishing on average. Now imagine the expression on the face of Howard Phillips over at Nintendo of America when he received Super Mario Bros. 2 for evaluation. They didn't even have a million copies of the original sold in the country yet. The console was available in like two cities. Who would want this game? There was no audience for the extra hard Mario. If anything, releasing the title would carry a good chance of confusion. People picking up the sequel, thinking it was better, as their first game, and getting no introduction to the mechanics whatsoever, just death on every screen. It could put people off Mario forever. So, Howard recommended a tough but entirely reasonable choice, not to release Super Mario Bros. 2 in the West. And it wouldn't be, in that console generation. The same summer of 1986, Taito got one of its all-time classics into the arcades, Bubble Bobble, designed by Fukio Mitsuji, we know from the Halley's Comet game. Bubble Bobble was a lot like the original Mario Brothers, with single-screen stages and cooperative play and enemies that had to be eliminated by first trapping them in a bubble and then popping it. But Bubble Bobble was cute, and it had 100 levels with different layouts and a final boss, and there were power-up weapons with special effects and secrets, and when the level timer ran out, you didn't lose, but instead had to evade invincible enemies. So all the best features to reward skilled play, and tons of content. Bubble Bobble was a major top-of-the-charts hit, the start of a long-running franchise, and one of the games that helped Taito crawl out from the shadows of every other Japanese arcade company back into relevance. November 86 brought Sega's first direct answer to Super Mario, Alex Kidd in Miracle World. Well, according to a recent-ish interview with its designer Kotaro Hayashida in The Untold History of Japanese Game Developers, the game did not start as a Mario rival. It started as a game based on a new manga, Dragon Ball, launched in November 84. It seems that Sega got the license, a team at its console games division got to work, then they took too much time or something else happened, and Sega lost the license. But this was late 1985, Super Mario Bros. Is all the rage, so Sega does the same thing Escape did to Wonder Boy and tells the Dragon Ball developers to change the characters and convert whatever they had to a much-needed Mario-like game for its Master System console. But they wanted to make it different in as many ways as possible, which resulted in, say, swapping which of the two buttons on the controller was the jump button, just so that it wasn't like in Mario. Years later, Kotaro Hayashida would laugh at his own silly choices. I don't know why they bothered with the superficial changes, because the protagonist of this so-called Super Mario clone was a martial artist who punched enemies in the face, smashed rocks with his fists, collected money to buy stuff in the shop, including a motorcycle, you had an inventory screen to keep track of helpful items, and when you got to bosses, in a Dragon Ball reference, instead of just fighting them, you challenged them to a game of rock-paper-scissors. And it was serious. If you lost at rock-paper-scissors, you lost a life and had to redo the stage. So Mario's new challenger was literally Goku. And you know what? Mario lost. In Europe and Brazil, where the affordable Master System outsold the good-luck-finding one NES, Alex Kidd was the icon of video gaming. In Master System 2, Sega would even put the game on a ROM inside the console so that you had Alex Kidd in Miracle World by default. And there would be more games with the guy. In December 86, Japan got the Famicom port of Nightlaw, programmed by a company called Tose for Jaleco. Jaleco had already released an MSX port in 85, but the new version tried to take advantage of the better graphics hardware and padded out the content by adding multiple stages with various room layouts and extra challenges like invisible items. In 1987, apart from the great Gianna sisters, we get Ninja-kun Ashura no Shou from UPL, also known as Ninja Kid 2, also known in America as Red Action. Ninja-kun is another series that switched from an arena jumping game to scrolling stages. A single run through the game would have 31 levels, but there were more. Some had alternative versions. So again, the structure was less linear than in Mario. Some levels were vertical, some were horizontal, sometimes they had dead ends and you had to backtrack. But the best feature was the Ninja Kid himself. After the first game, the team at UPL massively improved the character's ability to move. In addition to running and jumping, he could crouch and crawl, he could cling to walls and jump off walls, and if he was falling from a great height, you could press a button and make the ninja roll on landing instead of getting stunned. You could get new weapons and then switch between them on the go, bombs here, a boomerang-style blade there, though underwater you'd be only fighting with a sword. The developers clearly had fun making their ninja character capable of doing all the things you'd expect of a ninja. Well, apart from being sneaky. But you were fighting demons, and they're probably hard to sneak up on anyway. I haven't talked about Britain for a while. Well, in the summer of 87, the UK got Dizzy. Specifically, Dizzy, the ultimate cartoon adventure. And it was developed for the Spectrum, because they still love their speckies over there. I'll go into the details of the Dizzy series in a later episode, because they were action-adventure games with using items to solve puzzles and backtracking, and of course, tons of egg puns. There had to be egg puns, because many characters, including the main one, were eggs. And your egg had a peculiar quirk to the jumping physics. You rolled on landing. Not by choice like a ninja, you often had to. This made traversal across the game's many, many screens extra tricky, and that's not even counting all the enemies and death pits. The same summer, in Japan, Nintendo released Yume Kōjō, Doki Doki Panic. The title was developed for Fuji Television to promote an event called Yume Kōjō, Dream Factory, and this wasn't the first time Nintendo worked with the TV people. As it happens quite a lot, Nintendo did not start making this tie-in game from scratch, but converted a prototype being hammered together by a new designer, Kensuke Tanabe, whose ideas were programmed at another contractor, SRD. They were trying to make smooth vertical scrolling work, since Super Mario Bros. Had none of that, and I suppose it was a bit embarrassing. They had a functional mock-up of a game about jumping up and down in vertically scrolling levels, lifting items and throwing items, stacking blocks, or grabbing and throwing the other player to climb something or other. Shigeru Miyamoto looked at this and felt that it lacked something. Turned out it was horizontal scrolling, like in his Super Mario. And this is when Fuji TV came in and asked for a game to feature mascot characters of an upcoming Future Media Expo. And they got their game, with four playable characters, each with slightly different jump physics, and lots of enemies looking like or wearing masks, which was a theme for the event. Another theme of the event appears to be Arabian Nights, since that's what the characters were styled as, and the game presented each world as a chapter in a storybook, something we've already seen in Arabian. Also, if you compare Doki Doki Panic to Ninja-kun, even the original, it's funny how Nintendo ended up with similar-looking mountains as vertical pillars with ledges, and short ninjas in colored robes wearing white masks. Meanwhile, Nintendo of America still didn't have a Super Mario Bros. 2, and his boss Minoru Arakawa was getting annoyed. But one day, he saw the Yume Kōjō event game, it wasn't too bad oddly enough, so he asked if it could perhaps be converted into a Mario title for his branch? It was using some Mario sprites and objects already. I don't know what the exact contract terms between Nintendo and Fuji Television were, but evidently the transformation was possible. And for the third time this episode alone, a game developed for one project got a makeover to be sold as something else. It was a makeover that did not really change the game, but improved lots of small details. With more time on their hands, Nintendo artists were able to animate many sprites, breathing new life into levels, some visuals were made more interesting, they got rid of a blackface-looking mask, all good changes. The four characters of the original game got swapped for the Mario crew, keeping their peculiar jump properties. Mario became a balanced, boring character, Luigi got his high jump and for the first time was taller, Princess Toadstool, now playable, learned how to glide, while Toad, a mushroom person, jumped poorly but ran fast because he was the shortest. I don't think that's how running works. But these traits would stay with the characters in many later Mario games, along with some of the enemies first appearing in the Dream Factory game, like the Shy Guys, robed ninjas with white masks. This second Super Mario Bros. 2 was released by Nintendo of America in October 1988. Finally, Japan and America had a parity. But no, the very same month, Japan got Super Mario Bros. 3. It was good. I mean, it was just another Famicom Super Mario by Shigeru Miyamoto and Takashi Tezuka, but they'd learned their lessons after the questionable number 2. The third game was not for hardcore fans, it was for everyone, the first new Mario for everyone in Japan in years. Instead of a glorified pack of extra levels, the game offered new power-up items and transformations, new moves for regular Mario and Luigi, mini-games adding a bit of variety, in particular to the still-alternating two-player mode, new enemies, improved graphics, and a world map of sorts. Every set of levels in the game took place in a thematic world presented as a board game map with spaces Mario moved between. It was a fancy menu and still pretty linear, but certainly a fresh look, and I suppose helped to compete when games like Mighty Bomb Jack and Ninja Kun 2 and others had branching paths. And the reason Nintendo developers were able to cram all of it into a cartridge was that memory prices kept falling and they had several times more ROM space to work with than 3 years before. Super Mario Bros. 3 was a bigger and better game than the original, and it got promoted on a grander scale too. Namely, the 1989 film The Wizard was a feature-length ad that let American kids get a first glimpse of the game in action, and even learn about a secret in one of the levels before the game's American release in early 1990. But the third time was not the charm when it came to sales. Nothing could beat the original in that. And nothing could beat it in merging ideas many designers had been toying with for years and giving players something that felt both radically new and yet familiar and intuitive. Also, Super Mario Bros. 3 had to compete with new 16-bit titles, but I'm not going into those today. What I am going into is that these games finally had a name at this point. It appears, and by that I mean the whole internet is referring to a single book, that the modern name of this kind of action was worked out in the British gaming press of the late 80s. And I can see why. They had to cover lots of games for consoles and micros, page area had been at a premium for the entire decade, even in editions that dealt with a single platform like the Spectrum. A very common style of review for anything minor was a couple of paragraphs next to a screenshot, sometimes literally a photo of the screen. You can feel the struggle of writers trying to describe interesting crap games under these constraints, and even with more regular stuff, they had to spend whole sentences explaining the basic idea. So a great sigh of relief rolled over Britain when amidst the flood of Marios and Giannas and Dizzys and Alexes, someone coined the term platform game. And it fit. These were games where you jumped or climbed between platforms, whatever they were. And then you get the verb platform as a short for jumping between the platforms. By the end of the decade, reviewers could just say, oh, it's a platform game with these new features, it's okay. 9 out of 10. I'll be using the term platform game anachronistically in later episodes, because it beats not having the right word. After 2 episodes of trying it on purpose, I can vouch for that. But first, I'll use it correctly. Because the same year America got its third Super Mario, Europe caught a glimpse of the future of platform games. In the summer of 1990, French publisher Infogrames released a game by an equally French programmer, Christophe de Dinichan, Alpha Waves. And it was the first really three-dimensional platform game. Rather than play make-believe with the isometric perspective, it offered polygon-based graphics, very primitive by today's standards, but incredible on the Atari ST, because the camera could move freely following your movements. You controlled a shape of some kind, automatically hopping between trampolines, there was no jump button, and navigated cube-shaped rooms in different colors, trying to reach doors, taking you to other rooms. It was as basic as it sounds, and yet Christophe honored the legacy of Zaxxon and put a reference shadow directly under your vehicle. There were no enemies, not much of a plot, but that shadow had to be there, because without it, Alpha Waves would have been unplayable. And as an extra convenience, the game automatically panned the camera down whenever you jumped, so that you could always see that shadow, you could always see what you're about to land on. It's a pretty influential game, actually, so I'll return to it at some point. To try and sum it all up, over these 2 episodes, we've observed a long struggle between a jump, that is, committing to a certain arc of movement, on the one hand, and control over the game on the other. It turned out players wanted both. Yeah, we like hopping around, but would it be too hard to let us change our mind halfway through? No, not just pick how we jump when we jump, but in the air? And dying after falling from too great a height? That sucks too. It made no sense, but players wanted the idea of jumping rather than a simulation of jumping. And so, just like when chess queens and bishops suddenly learned to dash across the board because it was more fun that way, video game jumping became downright magical. Shigeru Miyamoto gets the credit for nailing it just right, but he was neither the only nor the first designer trying to tackle jumping. And even if Shigeru Miyamoto had dropped the ball on platform games after Donkey Kong, Thaxter and maybe even Ghosts and Goblins were right there to keep the concept going. But if I were to pick one game out of the past two episodes that was the most advanced for its time, years ahead of everyone else, it would be Jump Bug by Alpha Denshi. It's 1981, Scramble is still new, Donkey Kong is super new, and out comes this scrolling jumping game with controllable jumps, open air, underground and underwater stages. Sure, you couldn't stop jumping or go slower, but the decade of interesting crab games has to earn its reputation somehow. Also, today we've run into two companies that were like mirror images of one another. Ultimate Play the Game and HAL Laboratory. Both had an uncommon expertise in their own countries. British Ultimate designed cabinets for the Japanese market with the hardware popular in Japan. HAL worked with Western Micros based on the MOS 6502, very few in Japan used. And then both got extremely lucky. In Britain, Sinclair released the Spectrum, a bestseller built around Japan's favorite processor they could get on a discount, while in Japan, Nintendo chose the 6502 for its new console. And both HAL and Ultimate jumped at the chance, though in case of Ultimate, only a few years later it had to ditch the Speccy and become Rare, and also make games for the NES. Now, where do we go from here? Some may have noticed that in my coverage of platform games, I've skipped over plenty of more combat-oriented ones, closer to Ghosts and Goblins or Thexter. But they were the ones that boomed in the late 80s, because while Mario was exciting, action movie-like platform titles with tons of enemies and explosions were even more exciting. So we'll give them a separate episode. But first, we've got this other kind of game that's been tapping on our shoulder asking for attention for quite a while now. Ever since Sega's Heavyweight Champ, and then Karateka, and now Kung Fu Master, they've been out there, getting pumped up. We gotta finally give some time to games about beating the crap out of people. Or else. This has been Computer Game Evolution. Thank you for listening, thanks to LegoFan94 for covering the hosting, and donate to good causes.